No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can send us a question through our chat box, and we'd love to talk to you. And today is a great day, and we're going to have a celebration of sorts. We hope to have a member of Congress, Congressman Jamie Raskin, with us in a few minutes. But yay, the House of Representatives passed a bill on Friday that would make the District of Columbia the 51st state. What do you think of that, Maria? Yeah.
I think it's very promising, and I'm so happy to be a part of this. Thank you to you and your generosity with introducing me to the entire concept and shadow politics, too. And I just want to say to our listeners, the senator had Father's Day last week with his wife and three children. How was it?
It was great. You know what? First of all, I got a box of donuts from my youngest daughter that was sent from Arlington, Virginia, and were still warm when they got here. I don't know how they got it, because that's about a 20-minute drive. And so I started out my day with a box of Duck Donuts. They're famous here in Washington. And then my three kids got together and gave you and me a Father's Day gift, Maria. They bought me a new chair.
I was going to guess that, actually.
They bought me a chair that didn't squeak, because I got so many complaints about the squeaky chair that about a month ago, I replaced it with the old chair that I used to use. But the old chair was so worn out that, you know, I was hobbled every time I would get out because my rear end was so sore from sitting in it. So I want our listeners to know I suffered for all of you so that I didn't squeak. But now,
but as the backstory, because if some listeners are new to the program, the story is that Michael had a chair that anytime he moved, we could hear that there was movement going on. And I never said anything because it's live. And, you know, sometimes that's what happens. And you pull the curtain behind the broadcast. And, you know, we have foibles and flaws. But I guess enough people said something to you directly that, yeah, you decided to take it out. But
you know,
how great that they did that for you.
Yeah, Karen complained about it every week, and Karen's one of the people that works on the show, and yeah, so finally now I have a chair that's comfortable and does not squeak, thanks to the three wonderful Brown children.
Yay, Brown family.
Resources. Yeah.
And
so
then let's talk, too, about your elections in the District of Columbia and two of the women that we interviewed who were running for Ward 2 and Ward 4.
So that's exactly what happened. And this is how we're spinning it. If you want to get elected in the District of Columbia, you better come on Shadow Politics. Because, yes, we had
we're the good luck charm.
We are the good luck charm. And we had Janice Lewis George, and we had Brooke Pinto. Brooke won in Ward 2. And actually, in addition to that, Maria, these are the primary elections. But in the District of Columbia, we're so solidly Democrat that if you win the Democratic primary, you win the general election. We've never had anybody win the primary and not win the general election. So they're a shoo-in. But Brooke is strangely enough, because she's replacing a council member that resigned, also won the special election.
So I think she's already been sworn in
and is taking off, will take office tomorrow.
Well, and the backstory for the listeners is that she could have won the primary, but not won the seat, which meant that the Congress member who had resigned, he could have won that, and then she would have only been in office until November, basically, or I guess January.
Well, the other way around. The other person that won the special election, but they both won.
Okay.
And now we're so excited to have Congressman Raskin is joining us. He's online, too. Let's get him on the show. Let me just tell you a few things before. Let me introduce him. Congressman Jamie Raskin is the congressman from the 8th District of Maryland. He serves on the House Judiciary Committee, the Committee on Oversight and Reform, which our delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton also serves on, and the Committee on House Administration. He's been a leading advocate for D.C. statehood. He is an eloquent spokesperson for the cause, and we're so happy to have him here with us tonight. Congressman Raskin, welcome to the show.
Michael, I'm delighted to be with you. Good evening.
I'm so happy to have you here. And before we go on any further, let me just say that I first met Jamie Raskin before he got elected to Congress, and he was out there stumping for the rights of D.C. citizens even back then. He's always been a strong advocate. Over the last couple of days, your commentary on the floor was really, really amazing, Congressman. You said everything that needed to be said, and you've really been a leader on this. So thank you for helping us take the first step out of our indentured servitude in the last 219 years. And Maria Sanchez, who's also with us, Congressman, is one of the few, unfortunately, few Republicans out there who is a strong supporter of D.C. statehood. So welcome to our show. And let me ask you first up, explain to our listeners, please, what you think this means, that we've taken this big step in the House of Representatives.
Well, it's a huge step forward, obviously, because the last time it came up in 1993, it failed 2-1 in the House. And I guess there was a bare majority of Democrats who voted for it. But on Friday, every Democrat but one, my colleague Colin Peterson from a conservative rural district in Minnesota, voted for it, which means that you now have not only one of the two major political parties, but the larger major political party fighting for statehood admission. And if you look at it historically, that's always been a crucial step because either the party is able to make it happen itself if it's got concurrent majorities and the White House, or it's able to use its power to fight for a trade with a statehood admission favored by the other party. So I think just in terms of the overall dynamics of the political system, it's just a major breakthrough for the long-suffering citizens of D.C.
I agree.
Congressmember, may I ask you, what was the sentiment like? Did it feel historic prior and after the vote?
Well, I think so. I mean, there's so many wrenching and dramatic things going on in our country. And to me, it had the sense of historical inevitability and gravity about it. And, you know, I've been involved in a lot of struggles, which at first look completely impossible, and then suddenly, on the turn of a dime, become inevitable. And one of them was marriage equality, which I was the sponsor and floor leader for in the Maryland State Senate when I was a state senator. And I remember when I first got to the state Senate, I was elected then back in 2006, and people saying that this was impossible. It could never happen. There's no way you could overcome church opposition, and this would divide. It would wreck the Democratic Party and so on. In fact, marriage equality and the rights of the LGBTQ community have become pretty much the glue of the Democratic Party, and the younger generations all completely embrace it. And I think that D.C. statehood is right about at the same point that marriage equality was when we first started getting legislative action on it in the mid-2000s. And, of course, it happened in 2012, you know.
That's a heartening statement.
It really is. And let me add to what I said previously about the congressman, how important it is to have him as a neighbor in Maryland. You know, we had a hard time getting some people. Steny Hoyer, who's somebody I've known for 40 years from when I worked at the DNC, he was a latecomer. And Mark Warner, who I actually worked with at the DNC, who's a senator from Virginia, was a latecomer. So now we have a whole plethora of our neighbors. We have both senators from Maryland. We have both senators from Virginia. We have congressmen from both Maryland and Virginia on the bill. And that's really important because for years, our neighbors were a stumbling block. So let me ask you, Congressman, because you so eloquently answered these questions when they came up on the floor, can we talk about a few of the objections that the Republicans have brought up? First and foremost, the idea that the founding fathers wanted the people of the District of Columbia to be disenfranchised. What do you have to say to that comment?
It's false. Everyone who the founders thought should be enfranchised, meaning white male property owners over the age of 21, they thought should be enfranchised without regard to geography, and they certainly didn't imagine that people living in existing states, Maryland and Virginia, would be disenfranchised by virtue of the stated session. In fact, one of the things we weren't able to get into, just because there was so little time to answer all of the disinformation on the floor, but for the first decade, people who lived in the federal district, the land set aside for the federal district, continued to vote in their former states. And it was the Organic Act in 1801, which somehow just divested those people of voting rights. Now, it wasn't a large population. It was mostly a seasonal population, and so it didn't seem like a big deal. But I think that the people who just fought a revolution on the principle of no taxation without representation, consent of the governed, would not have enjoyed the idea of 700,000 people being disenfranchised simply because they breathed the same air as the people who come to represent other Americans. All of which is to say, look, that they hinge their entire argument on the idea that you cannot convert the federal district, the seat of government that is provided for in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, into a voting state itself. And I guess I'm agnostic on that proposition, but it's completely irrelevant because nobody is proposing turning the district into a state. Congresswoman Norton's legislation shrinks the federal district. It redraws it to the federal capital service area, the mall, which is the Capitol, the White House, the Supreme Court, the other federal buildings. Congress continues to exercise police jurisdiction over that federal district under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, and the remaining federal lands are yielded to the new state and then admitted under Congress's powers under Article 4 of the Constitution, which is the only way that states have come into the Union. It's happened 37 times when 37 new states have been admitted, almost all of them over objections like this. And one of the funny things was when the floor leader for the Republicans said there are only two categories of states or two categories of entities that have been admitted as states. And he said territories and then parts of other states. He said, but that's it. And I said, I've got a one-word answer for you, Texas. Texas was a republic. And indeed, yeah. It was said at the time that congressional power under Article 4 does not extend to admitting a foreign country. And the answer in practice was, this is a political question under Article 4. It says that Congress has the power, which is a plenary power. It's exhaustive. It's comprehensive to admit new states. And so it's up to Congress to decide what new states were going to be. Another fallacy I didn't even have time to get to was advanced by Congressman Harris from Maryland, this sole Republican from Maryland, and a few others, saying that the land actually belongs to Maryland, and so this can't happen without the consent of the Maryland legislature. Well, if you go back and you look at the cession of the land from the Maryland General Assembly to Congress, it is an absolute, irreversible, fee simple, unconditional, meaning it's just like selling someone your house. Once they bought your house, it belongs to them, and they can tear the house down and start over. They can sell it to someone else. It belongs to them. It doesn't belong to you anymore. In any event, of course, the 7 out of the 8 members of the Maryland delegation were supporting statehood yesterday because there are important ties culturally, politically, socially, economically of people in this region with people in the soon-to-be new state. And we are deeply invested in the success of this new state. Why would we want to disenfranchise and disempower our neighbor?
Well, you know, one other thing that the lone Republican, and we should point that out, that 7 out of 8 members of the Maryland delegation supported us, and 7 out of 8 are Democrats. But the lone Republican, Andy Harris, it really amazes me. On the one hand, they talk about retrocession, giving the land back to Maryland. And then on the other hand, they say that we can't do this. We can't become a state because the founding fathers never wanted the capital to be controlled by a state. Well, how do we move the capital to Maryland and not have Maryland surround the capital? You know, doesn't Maryland become the controlling state there then with undue influence? And we all understand these are red herrings. You know, they say we have to amend the Constitution, but as you know, Congressman, no state has ever been entered into the Union by an amendment to the Constitution. And they also understand that the Constitution's really only been amended 17 times since the Bill of Rights. And in that same amount of time, we've been admitted 37 states. So much easier to become a state than to amend the Constitution. But let me ask you, what does this do? You know, as somebody that's been in politics for 40 years, I see, and I think you've already alluded to this, that we have a much stronger bargaining position due to what happened in the House on Friday. What do you think that means for us in the Senate? Is there a negotiation which we can make with the Senate, do you think, to get equal rights for the people of the District of Columbia, even if it's not in the traditional, you know, in the form of the legislation that's been put forth?
Well, all statehood politics, like all politics in American history, has been coalitional politics. So you get people who don't live in the territory that wants to be admitted, or the district that wants to be admitted, behind it in a big way, and you get them pushing for it, right? Well, now there are lots of people pushing for D.C. statehood, and the argument is made on terms of civil rights, and that appeals to millions of people across the country. And I think that Puerto Rico is just maybe a half step behind. I mean, I think that there are some people in Puerto Rico who still entertain the dream of independence. But I think that the practical problems alone to independence are so overwhelming that it's not for real. And Puerto Rico has seen recently what a high price you pay when you're not a state in terms of Hurricane Maria relief, in terms of COVID-19 relief, the way that the district, you know, experienced that $750 million ripoff by shenanigans of the Republican Party in Congress. So all of which is to say that Puerto Rico's allies and D.C.'s allies, and those are allies politically, partisan, ideologically, ethnically, racially, all of the allies have got to get together and put pressure on the Democratic and the Republican parties to make that deal. I mean, that's not the only way it can happen, but I think that that's one obvious way that it can happen, and I think the times demand it.
May I ask, I need to know some history here, because I don't know Congressmember as much as the senator does about you personally. How did you come to be an advocate and passionate about D.C. for statehood? Was there a learning curve for you, or were you always both feet in, or how did you get here?
Well, one thing you should know is that I am very much a suffrage radical and a very strong participatory Democrat. So I think there's no greater honor in a political career than to be able to fight for people's enfranchisement and people's ability to participate. But I know the issue very well, although I was born in Maryland. I grew up mostly in Washington, D.C., although I spent most of my life in Maryland. But I feel the issue very strongly, and I know people in D.C., and I know that it does need allies, and I consider that a matter just of democratic self-respect, that when you see people, your fellow countrymen and women, fighting for their democratic rights, that's got to be your struggle, too.
Nice. Thank you.
Congressman, the question I asked you earlier was a little more pointed, and let me put it to you this way. If I was a negotiator for the District of Columbia, I might go over to the Senate and say, look, you've just had an overwhelming bill passed for statehood in the District of Columbia. You're about to get two new liberal Democratic senators. Isn't there some compromise that you would like to reach? For example, when we had the D.C. Voting Rights Act, we had Susan Collins, Voinovich, Orrin Hatch. We had several Republicans on the bill. Is there some lesser thing that you think people will attempt to try to negotiate out of this? Do you think that's a possibility? Like a vote for Eleanor in the House.
Perhaps, but I just think that it's way too late in the day for any kind of half or one-third or one-fifth measures, or three-fifth measures, perhaps. I think that, when people have a taste of real equality, they're not going to settle for much less. I mean, the only real deal that can be made is one that is time-honored, which is if there are other people who've been left out of equal participation in the union, now is the time to do it. The Democratic National Platform has had for decades D.C. statehood and full political autonomy in there, and the Republican platform has had in Puerto Rican statehood, and it's a peculiarity of Puerto Rican politics that the Republicans are the ones pro-statehood, and the Democrats are generally defending the Commonwealth status, or some, I suppose, support independence. But I think as it becomes more and more of a concrete, real thing, you're going to see everybody flowing towards the statehood side in Puerto Rico. And then the Republican Party is going to have to face a moment of reckoning on this, as with so many other issues. Do you get with the tide of history and act on what you say your principles are or not? Most states have entered the union in these kinds of deals, whether it's Kansas, Nebraska, or Hawaii, Alaska, or Maine, Kentucky. One side says, all right, we really want to see these people enter. The other side says, we want to see these people enter, and let's just do it together. And that, of course, was the history leading up to the Civil War of, the pro-slavery and anti-slavery states being bound together in the admission.
And what happens now? What's the timeline?
Well, as with everything else good that comes out of the House of Representatives, Mitch McConnell has said he's not interested and he won't bring it up. You know, we'll see whether there are events that take place that push this to the forefront. But it has taken place in time for the presidential election, so it's going to be very much part of the presidential contest. It's taking place in advance of the political conventions, you know, I think that advocates of DC statehood have every reason now to consolidate their position within the Democratic Party, to work with people like you, Maria, friends on the Republican side, to establish a beachhead within the Republican side, to look at it not in partisan terms, but in patriotic terms, and to make sure it's on the agenda for very early in 2021.
And that's how I see a Congress member. It's fair. It's parity. It's right. It has nothing to do with politics or party, as far as I'm concerned. But I know that I'm the exception.
Well, good for you. You know, I think that President Trump, characteristically and unsurprisingly, really dragged the subject down into the mud when he said that the Republicans would be very, very stupid to support statehood for Washington, D.C., because the you know, it would result in two senators. I mean, that really degrades the enterprise of statehood entirely, looking at it just as, you know, what happens politically in terms
right.
of who gets elected.
Through that lens. But correct me if I'm wrong, I thought when Trump took office initially, his car said something about D.C. for statehood around the plates. Do you remember, Michael?
No, he never did that. He never put the plates. We asked him to put the plates on, of course, but he didn't. What he did say very early on is you should give the people of the District of Columbia what they want. And people interpreted that to mean statehood, because that's
of
what
course.
We want. But he never enunciated that. He's to my recollection, he has never used the S word. But Congressman, as you talk about consolidating our base and forming a beachhead, what do you think about the Black Lives Matter movement? Has this helped bring the issue forward? Because we know that in 1993, 40% of the Democrats that voted no on the bill, and now we have the solid support of the Democratic Party. We also know that the District of Columbia was 56% black in 1993, and it's 47% minority black today. So how much do you think race has to do with this? And is this new kind of awareness about systematic racism? Because I can't imagine anything more systematically prejudiced than saying that, you know, ensconcing in the Constitution of the United States that people are geographically disenfranchised. So do you think that the Black Lives Movement gives us an opportunity to establish a beachhead?
Absolutely. But on Thursday and Friday, we passed two pieces of serious structural systemic reform for America. And one on Thursday was the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which is by far the most sweeping, comprehensive, and serious reform of policing in American history, passed by Congress. And the next day, we passed D.C. statehood in the House. So those are both acts of structural political change that will change the character of American politics and American government and the way that people experience life in our country. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement and all of these glorious young people out at the barricades across America have utterly transformed politics in our time. As we were talking, a news item just flashed up on my telephone saying Mississippi just voted to change its flag, getting rid of the Confederate insignia.
Yes, nice.
That's historic that's mm-hmm. taking place. I mean, it took a while, right? It's 2020. The Civil War ended in 1865, and they still had the Confederate battle flag as part of, you know, their state emblem. So it does take time. This is an historical process, but I think that the conjunction of all these events cements in people's misconception that this is an historical imperative and an inevitability, because, like Tocqueville said in Democracy in America, democracy is always either shrinking, contracting, and shriveling away, or it's expanding and deepening for the people of the country.
Well, you know, we're going to have to have you back another time to talk about flags, since you brought it up, Congressman. I'm a proud Marylander, grew up in Maryland, graduated from the University of Maryland, but I really don't get the flag. It's very, very busy. You know, the D.C. flag, 3 stars, 2 bars. The Maryland flag, we've got everything but the kitchen sink in there. But that's for another day.
Well, we love our flag. You know, we love our flag. It's quirky the way a lot of things Maryland are, but it's a beautiful and compelling flag. But I do like the D.C. flag, too. And I got to say that the name of your new state at first struck me as a little bit clunky, but it's grown on me, Washington, D.C., Washington Douglas Commonwealth, because the Douglas part really does establish that linkage between Maryland and the new state. Frederick Douglass, of course, was born into slavery on the Y River Plantation on the Eastern Shore and escaped to freedom and became a great abolitionist freedom fighter. And then ended up in Washington, D.C. as the Marshal of the District of Columbia and was a great figure in the Reconstruction. And I think that America needs a new Reconstruction now in terms of public health, in terms of police-civil relations, in terms of the environment, in terms of the government. And I think it's a great first act to bring Washington, D.C. into being, to be part of this third and, let's hope, finally transformative Reconstruction for the country.
Well, you know, since we talked there for a moment, or you brought up the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which passed, by the way, 236 to 181, again, pretty much along partisan lines. And I understand that Senators Booker and Harris have a similar bill in the Senate. We don't expect it to pass in the Senate, though, do we?
Well, their bill is, I wouldn't say it's similar. Perhaps you could say it's in the same hemisphere, but it's a tremendously diluted version of our bill. I mean, we start off by banning chokeholds and strangleholds. They don't do it. We ban racial, ethnic, and religious profiling. They don't do it. We ban the corrupt doctrine of qualified immunity in Section 1983 civil rights cases. They don't do it. I mean, a lot of their bill is more studies and more commissions and that kind of thing. And the country is ready for real action. I mean, we're in a new century here, and, you know, people have seen enough, and people do want a structural change in relations between our own police forces and our communities.
Why do you think that their bill doesn't have the teeth that your bill does?
Well, I think the Republican Party is having an identity crisis and can't really decide which way it wants to go. I mean, it is the party of Lincoln. It should be in the forefront of everything we're talking about today. But it has unfortunately taken over the old Dixiecrat elements from the Democratic Party, which is a shrinking and rapidly vanishing part of American politics. But it's still there. And there are some people, I suppose, who think they can stitch together enough sentiment of, you know, neo-Confederate constituencies and anti-choice and large corporations that want more aid from the federal government on a selective basis and somehow create a majority. I think it's way too late for that. And to me, it's sad because, you know, one of the great honors of being in my job is I get to serve in the same institution where Abraham Lincoln once served, just for one term. But, you know, what he did when he was there was he tried to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. I mean, that was the major bill he worked on as a congressman from Illinois. And Lincoln would be turning over in his grave at what's become of the party that he founded on, you know, anti-racist and anti-secessionist ideas.
Can you explain to me quickly, Congressman, because I was beat up by police officers in the early 1970s, back when I was a hippie and a radical, yeah, and out in the streets yelling at people. But explain what qualified immunity is. What protection does this give the police? Because it really seems like it's an outrageous idea to me. But I don't know that I fully understand it. What exactly is qualified immunity?
Qualified immunity is a totally court-made doctrine, which says that if somebody sues for civil damages under Section 1983, which is the major federal civil rights law, giving people the right to sue if governmental agents violate their constitutional rights. And this doctrine says, well, if you prove that the government violated your constitutional rights, you prove they violated your due process rights, your right to bodily dignity, you prove they violated your right to equal protection, say you're someone like in George Floyd's position, that's just the first step. You've proven they violated your civil rights. Now you've got to prove, under the qualified immunity doctrine, that the police had reason to know that what they were doing to you was established by a prior case to be one of unconstitutional state action. And so people have been getting off simply by showing, oh, well, in one case, for example, police chased a suspect through a bunch of backyards, and they ended up in one person's backyard. They threw the suspect down, and there was a family that was sitting back there with their kids. They told everybody to get down, and a dog came out of the house and started barking at the police officers. And one of the officers started shooting at the dog, but missed and hit one of the kids. So the child was grievously wounded physically and mentally and emotionally, and the family sued to recover against the police. And the court found, well, yeah, the police violated your constitutional rights, but the police had no reason to know that if they shot at a dog, missed the dog, and hit a kid, that would violate someone's civil rights under federal law, and therefore you can't recover. I mean, we've got dozens of cases like this. I mean, it's almost like saying if you flip it around that somebody goes and robs a bank, but their getaway car is a red van, and nobody's ever used a red van before. They've only robbed banks in a white van or a green van or something. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. And no legislature ever would have passed this. Is made up by a bunch of right-wing judges, and we got to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Wow.
I absolutely agree. Well, let me ask you also, Congressman, since you're on the Select Committee on the controversy, coronavirus, I don't know why I can't say that word, coronavirus crisis, you're a co-sponsor of the Rebuilding Main Street Act. What is the Rebuilding Main Street Act?
Well, this is our infrastructure legislation, which is an attempt to do what we should have done right after the 2016 election. I mean, had we had a different kind of president, even a different kind of Republican president, there would have been some bipartisan effort to say, let's bring the country together around a program of reinvestment in our decrepit roads and highways and transit systems, our ports and airports, our cybersecurity, the whole infrastructure of the country, public health, of course, has been deteriorating, and we've got to invest in it. But we have a president who has regarded his time in office as a money-making venture. I mean, he never stopped doing business. He refused to divest himself from more than 250 business corporations and ventures he's got around the world, and he's continued to take money from foreign governments. He's continued to plunder the federal government by taking millions of dollars at the golf courses and the hotels and so on. And so there was never any effort to bring us together to reinvest in America. And so we're partly what we're seeing now, in addition to the lethal incompetence and mismanagement and lying of the Trump presidency. We are also seeing the fruits of disinvesting in the country. And, of course, they did disband the pandemic response team in the National Security Council. And that's just reflective of the general neglect of the infrastructure that you need to really run a government. We are on the verge of becoming a failed state, a very rich but very failed state that can't deliver basic goods to the population, like health care, like security against pandemics, like equal administration of the laws without regard to race and ethnicity.
Along those lines, Congressmember, may I ask, because you're the chair of the Oversight Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, how is that playing out with all that's going on now in our culture?
Well, not well, of course. I mean, we have we've got an administration which routinely tramples the civil rights and civil liberties of the people. I mean, think about what took place in Lafayette Square. It was a massive injury, not just against the people of Washington, but against the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment contains six different rights, and each one of them was violated or offended in its own way, right? The right to peaceably assemble, the right to petition your government for a redress of grievances, which is precisely what the Black Lives Matter movement is all about, the right of freedom of speech, which has got to mean something more than tear gas in your face and a baton in the ribs, the right of free press, which was destroyed as reporters got shoved aside and their cameras stripped out of their hands and so on. The right to free exercise of religion, which was trampled when the president decided to crash the St. John's Church without an invitation, provoking a protest not just from the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, but the Catholic Bishop of Washington. And then no establishment of religion, which was the real aim of this bizarre and grotesque photo opportunity when the president decided to take a borrowed Bible, turn it upside down, and then hold it up over his head as if he was somehow the king of church and state at the same time.
Or a prophet and saint.
Yeah.
Well, exactly right. So you could say that he violated the First Amendment so he could cross the street and violate the First Commandment. He created a God above the Lord of the Bible in himself.
Well said.
Yes, very well said. And again, you've been such an eloquent spokesman for our cause on the floor. I watched the whole thing. That's the only thing that I would say to Maria about her earlier question to the congressman. The one thing that I kept on regretting as I was watching this unfold is that we couldn't be there.
Yes.
You know, that you couldn't have a large crowd there that would have cheered and,
yes,
you know, and then been brought to order by the chairman.
That was regrettable, definitely, that, you know, that there was nobody up there because of COVID-19 in the gallery. I regret it only that I didn't have enough time to answer all of the propaganda of the Republicans, for example. I never had the chance to respond to their new argument about the 23rd Amendment. A number of them spent their time saying that under the 23rd Amendment, President Trump and his family would now have three electoral college votes after the admission of the new state, which we know isn't true, because if it were true, they would be favoring statehood from New Columbia to give President Trump and his family three new electors. But, I mean, it's easily answered, of course, as you know, because the 23rd Amendment has an enforcement clause. Section 2 says that Congress has the power to enforce the provisions of this article. And all we need to do, in fact, we will be doing it with the statehood admission, is to deactivate the 23rd Amendment and not organize the electors and then move quickly to repeal the 23rd Amendment, which would happen in record time because nobody would have any reason to object to it. But this is the reason that they want to deny political representation and democracy to more than 700,000 American citizens.
Well, you know, and it's amazing how much misinformation is out there because, as you can imagine, there's all sorts of things being buzzed back and forth on the internet. And I've heard that said many times that you can't amend the Constitution to reverse a constitutional amendment. And we all know that isn't true because it wasn't the 21st Amendment that got rid of the amendment banning prohibition. So we know that can be done. But, yeah, there's just a ton of misinformation out there, and that's one of our problems. So that's what I want to ask you. We're going into the Senate. Last year, the D.C. government gave out in grants 70 times as much money for arts and humanities grants as they put into statehood grants. They put almost no money into the effort to make the District of Columbia state. As you know, I know that you've known Paul for a long time. You know that Paul and I aren't paid. We're almost not funded at all. For many years, we were not funded. Don't you think we need to put some money in this if we're going to build a bulkhead, a beachhead, and get people together and bring them again together around our cause? Don't we need to expend some money on this?
Well, I mean, I better not opine on the local budgetary decisions because I do think that's, you know, in this, as with every other matter, it's up to the people, you know, in the new state. But I will say that I think now is the time when Washington, D.C. needs to organize at a far more systematic and intense level than it ever has before the movement to upraise the issue, you know, in every possible context. So, I leave it to your wisdom and the wisdom of the other political leaders in D.C. to figure out how to do that. But now is definitely the time to strike.
Maria, do you have another question? We're starting to run out of time here.
I do, because I think part
of... And I have to go after this one, you guys.
Okay, thank you for your time, by the way. Part of the challenge is not just the disinformation, but the lack of information, that a lot of people don't know that D.C. isn't a state and what that means, and your budget and everything else. People are like, what? How can that be? So I think part of the cause should be refuting the disinformation, but also letting people know exactly what is the situation.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And let me just say, is there anything before you leave, Congressman, that you wanted to say that we haven't given you the opportunity to say?
Well, just on that last point, but one of the rare punches that they threw, which landed a little bit, was this idea that public opinion polls show that most Americans don't favor this. And I don't know what polls they're referring to, but that's got to be wrong. And I'm sure it all depends on exactly how you frame the question. If you say, you know, should we have a community of more than 700,000 tax-paying, draftable U.S. citizens who participated in every war and who are governed by the government of the United States and are not represented and want to be, should they be, I'm sure you'd get an overwhelming majority. I don't know what their poll says, but it probably says something like, do you want to enfranchise 700,000 government bureaucrats to take away your liberties or something like that? I mean, they started off really with the point, and I hope this is something that you guys pounce on, which was made by Chip Roy from Texas, that all of this is a diversion from what the Congress should be doing. It should be focused on real Americans, not people here, real Americans. And the first thing I pointed out when I got up was the overwhelming, first of all, federal employees are real Americans. Letter carriers and members of the armed services and the people who make sure we have clean air and clear water are real Americans. But the overwhelming majority of federal workers, 92% of them, live somewhere else, not in Washington, D.C. They live in California, in Texas, in Alaska, in Maryland, in Virginia, in Pennsylvania, and so on. And they're not disenfranchised because they're federal workers. And the overwhelming majority of people who live in Washington, D.C. are not federal workers. They are radio talk show hosts and school teachers and police officers and firefighters and business people and lawyers and doctors and et cetera. So, but that, I think that message has got to get out that, you know, this state will be a unique state in the sense that every state is a unique state. Each one has its own history, its own culture, its own values and attitudes and so on. But it is exactly equal in all of the ways that really count.
Well, I can't think of a better way to say it. So on that note, we're going to let you go, Congressman. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, for being on our show. And thank you even more for standing up for the 705,000 people that call themselves your neighbor. Wishing you all the best for you and your family. Stay safe. And I hope I get to see you soon.
Well, thank you very much. Happy 4th of July. And on behalf of a lot of Maryland, if not all of Maryland, we are wishing our friends in the coming new state well in this venture. And we are invested in your success.
Nice.
Thank you.
And belated Happy Father's Day also.
Yeah.
Thank you much. Bye-bye.
All right. See ya. Thanks. Well, you know, in wrapping up here, first I got to tell you that I was interviewed by Eleanor Clift earlier. We had her on our show. Mm-hmm. She wrote a piece for the Daily Beast on statehood, and she, in addition to interviewing me, she interviewed an ANC commissioner who I thought had the best quote that I've heard in a long time. She said that to her, this is just like the movie Miracle on 34th Street. You know that in the famous movie, mm-hmm. that they fight to prove that Santa Claus is real, and the post office comes in and certifies him as real. So the court has to accept him as real. And she said, if the post office thinks you're Santa and you're Santa, she said, when I go on Amazon and I click the state menu, DC pops up. And she said, so if the post office thinks you're Santa, then it stands to reason if Amazon thinks you're a state, then by golly, you're a state. And I think, you know, I think that's so cryptic because, you know, it's my personal belief that someday Amazon will rule everything, unfortunately. So maybe that's it. Maybe we'll just back into it through Amazon.
Because you're so designated by the almighty, omniscient, all-knowing Amazon.
Yeah. Yes. Which,
well, so there must have been ebullience in your offices and in your household on Friday.
Yeah, there
really were. Again, historic moments, but a beautiful one, and nothing like what happened in 1993. I mean, serious movement, progress, success. But how many guests have we had that says, you know, this is a groundswell. It feels differently than it has in the past. There is more consensus. There's more awareness. There's more passion. Almost all of our guests have said that about DC for statehood. So the momentum continues with what happened on Friday.
Yes, I absolutely believe it. And I want to thank all the people, all the activists out there who have worked on this, especially our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who never gave up, and people like Maria Sanchez, because, you know, we're getting what you and I are doing, Maria, I hope, is helping get the word out about this. And I think the internet, that's one thing that we didn't get to talk about. We talked about Black Lives Matter and other things that may be motivating the groundswell that we feel. But the internet is also doing that, right? We're now all connected. So it's easier to let people all around the country and all around the world understand what our problem is, because as you rightfully point out, most people don't get it. Most people don't understand it. So,
and it's not that they're ignorant. They haven't been informed. It's not that they're stupid. We don't teach it really. And so everyone just assumes, you know, this broad brush that, of course, they're Americans, aren't they?
Right,
they vote,
right,
aren't they?
Right. It's counterintuitive to think that people of the nation's capital don't have the same rights you do.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time. And, you know, usually I play a song in honor of our guests. And I look, that I looked at Maryland, my Maryland. You know, we still, I don't want to get onto this because this is an extension of the flag discussion, but we also stole, they also stole their state song in Maryland from, oh, it's to the tune of Oh Tannenbaum. So the song is Maryland, my Maryland, you know, but I had to settle for a song that I think says, gives an important message. It's by a guy that was born and raised in Maryland. It was written by him and it's sung by him. And he's now a member of Bruce Springsteen's band, has been for a while. So we're going to play for you, We All Sung Together by Nils Lofgren.
And as, again, we always want to be thankful and grateful as we are to our listeners who make us a part of your lives. We appreciate the opportunity to have these conversations, and we actually are humbled by your loyalty. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote.